Good morning.
Good morning.
It's great to have all of you here this morning. Thank you for joining us. Great to have all you visitors. Thank you for joining us as well. And we hope this is a great service for you. So Easter is a lot of things. And Easter is a term that is more general. It implies things like Easter bunnies, Easter eggs, which, by the way, I happen to know that I got a 1 pound solid chocolate Easter bunny from Sarah's, so I'm going to make good work of that here before long. You probably won't want to live with me afterwards, but I'm going to give it my best shot. But in any case, so Easter is a sort of a larger term. I prefer, particularly within the church, the term Resurrection Sunday. And I like the term Resurrection Sunday because 2,000 years ago, it absolutely blew people's minds that Jesus was able to resurrect himself after what he endured. Understand that people back then saw death differently than how we see death. Radically so. About 50% of the children who were born back then died. A significant percentage of women died in childbirth. I think about 20%. A sizable percentage of men died because they were conscripted to go to war. And then, of course, they had very little defense against things like plagues, epidemics, and things like that. So death was always swirling around the people who lived in that time. So if you compare the mortality for whatever that mortality was, or the source of that mortality, to the mortality that we have today, what we have today shrinks. It just pales in comparison to what people experienced then. So death was always in front of them. And it was something that they had to deal with on a daily basis. If we deal with a death in a year, that's fairly significant in our time. It would not be uncommon for them to deal with death in some fashion on a weekly, certainly on a monthly basis. Now, in that time, in those ancient of days, people were unsure about what happened to people who died. Regardless of the faith or the religion, there was always this sense of this great unknown. What's going to happen when I die? And so in whatever religion or philosophy, whether it was Platonists or Stoics or the Epicureans or the Gnostics or whoever it was, there was this sense in which there was a pretty good chance that things would not bode for them well once they left this world. That there was this sense in which if they didn't do everything right here, there would certainly be some kind of recompense, some kind of accountability for how they lived their life here, and that they would pay in the world to come. And so they were oftentimes very terrified of death because they had no assurance of what they might be spared from. So death was seen very differently. Now, in today's world, there are three ways in which you look at death. So if you're in the higher education and or science field, death is explained as annihilationalism, that you simply cease to exist, that there is nothing beyond this life, that it all ends when you die here, and there is nothing that happens to you in the next life because you simply cease to exist. Your soul is annihilated. It is gone. Which, if it were true, could be a pretty good deal. Because that means then, if there's no accountability in the next world, you and I can do anything that we want in this world. And that the greatest thing that we could possibly pursue, if there is no accountability in the next world, is the pursuit of pleasure, hedonism, to just do in this world what maximizes the most amount of pleasure, the most amount of time, and the more power I have, the more pleasure I can get. And you think, what's wrong with pleasure? There are a lot of people out there who have some pretty freaky ideas about what pleasure is. C.S. Lewis talks about in his book, part of the Chronicles of Narnia, but in the book, The Village of the Dawn Treader, they're on this ship, and they're sailing past this island. And one of the characters on the ship says, what's that island over there? In fact, I think I hear some screams and shouts and things like that. What is that island that we are passing? And the captain of the ship said, that is the island where all dreams come true. Now you might think that's a good thing, right? Because you think only good dreams. But there are a lot of people out there who think only bad dreams, horrible things. And if they have the power, they will do what they can do to maximize the greatest amount of pleasure the most amount of the time. So you see then, if there is no accountability in the world in which we live, in this life hereafter, we are free to do whatever we want. And we might pay a few penalties here and there, maybe some significant penalties here and there, but by and large, we can do anything we want because there will be no recompense, there will be no judgment, there will never be anything that we have to pay for. On the other hand, the second explanation about what happens with death is this. That God is just our buddy. And he loves us so much that it, as long as you are sincere and well-intended, everybody gets in. No one has to pay any kind of a price. It's all one great big freebie. Regardless of what you and I do, say 98% of what most people do, 99%, it's all theirs. They can waltz into heaven and they never have to worry about what God might say or what God might do. There is no accountability. Now, you and I know both, don't we? That when crime is committed, and there is no accountability on the part of the criminal, how do you feel? And you might think, what crimes have I committed? Why is it bad? It's just me. It's just what I'm doing. It doesn't matter. It's not like it's public or anything. Someone once said, there are no private sins. Because as soon as I do something that I shouldn't be doing, I compromise what I am. And when I compromise what I am, then I can't be to others what I need to be. So I'm operating at more of a deficit when I should be operating with more of a positive. Have you ever encountered somebody in your life that was looking to you to help them in some way, but you could not help them because you had your own issues? And they suffered as a result of the fact that you had your own issues? There are no private sins. And because God has arranged the world in which he's arranged it, he's arranged it in such a way that we have this symbiotic relationship with each other. We We live off of the benefits of other people, and they live off of ours. And that's how it's supposed to be. And when we withhold that, or we don't give it, then people in the world suffer. There's more than enough food in the world to feed the world's hungry. There are countless examples of that. The third way in which we see death is that we are distracted. See, people back then saw death so many times, and there were so much fewer things happening in their life that they had to face it on a regular basis. But today, oh no. You take any average person in the world today, and they have a gazillion things going on and all kinds of reasons and excuses not to look and to stare death in the face. And so oftentimes we don't think about death at all until it's imminent, either in the life of somebody that we love or in our own. And only then do we begin to wrestle with the question of what happens after death. Isn't this true? So when Jesus died on the cross 2,000 years ago, he said a lot of things. He said a lot of things about who he was and why he was there. He said a lot of things about the nature of man and what they needed. And he said a lot about what his purpose was in terms of filling in the deficit of what humans couldn't do for themselves. Some very powerful statements that cost him his life. So, when the Romans arrested him Thursday night, or I guess it would be Friday, and they beat him and scourged him, so that his face was bruised and battered and the crown of thorns shoved down in the skull of his head. His back looked like raw hamburger. And they hung him on the cross so that he slowly asphyxiated to death. A spear was driven into his side to make sure that he was dead. And then he was put into a tomb. Now, you might recount in the Gospel of John where Jesus is coming on his way to Jerusalem, and he gets this message from these two women, Mary and Martha. And they say to him, Jesus, your very good friend, Lazarus, is very sick. Would you please come and heal him? But Jesus delayed, and he didn't go to see Lazarus, his very good friend, and Lazarus died. And after Lazarus died, he waited still a couple more days, and then he said to the disciples, we need to go see Lazarus and Mary and Martha. And so they went, and when he arrived, one of the sisters went out and said, Lord, if you had been here, Lazarus would not have died. And Jesus looked at her and said, you need to understand that something greater is at play here in Lazarus' death. And it was at that point that the shortest verse in the whole Bible, Jesus wept, took place. And from there, Jesus went to see Lazarus at the tomb. Now, Lazarus had been in the ground for 3 days. And Jesus said, Lazarus, come forth. And Lazarus did. And he was resurrected. Now, the greater thing that was supposed to happen there was that Jesus demonstrated that he could resurrect the dead. So that in a short while later, in the future, when Jesus died, people would remember Lazarus, and they would remember the promise that Jesus said he would resurrect himself. And so he did. He laid in the tomb for 3 days, and he resurrected. Now you think, like, why 3 days? What was the big deal about that? Because pervasively throughout the Jewish culture was the belief that when you died, your soul hovered over your body for 3 days. So if Lazarus or Jesus had been resurrected prior to those 3 days, the Jews would have simply said, his soul was just hovering. It went back into him, and he came back to life. So no surprise there. But after 3 days, they believe the soul dissipated. It disappeared. So it would be impossible to be resurrected. So they wanted to remove any possibility. Jesus wanted to demonstrate any possibility that there was some other explanation about how he resurrected, how he defeated death. Because again, in the ancient world, there was nothing more powerful, more compelling, more terrifying than death. They could defeat vast armies. They could outlive plagues, all of those kinds of things, but they could never, ever, ever defeat death. So when Jesus defeated death, it got everyone's attention. And here we are, 2,000 years later, and I wonder exactly how much of our attention he still has in the defeat of death on our behalf. And you think, well, okay, so he defeated death. What's the big deal about that? Because if a person could defeat death, then he could do all these other things too, like forgiveness of sins, to be sacrificed on our behalf as an atoning sacrifice for our sin instead. And I'm going to get to some of that in a few minutes. So Jesus wanted to remove any other explanation other than it was him. Only a God could defeat death. And that is what we have believed, and that is what people have understood for 2,000 years. And some people think, well, so he wanted to remove any other explanation. You think, well, what other possible explanations are there? I mean, if Jesus died that horrible way in which he died, the beatings, the scourgings, the crucifixion, and yet he's still resurrected, surely there must be some other explanation than a resurrection. And so some people have tried to provide other explanations, like, well, the disciples stole the body. That's why he wasn't in the tomb. Except for, there was this giant rock that was several tons that had been rolled in front of the door that took many people to move the rock away from the entrance. Not only that, but there were Roman guards placed there who, on pain of their own life, if they failed in guarding that tomb, they too would have died. So if we read the historical record, the biblical historical record, as well as other people like the ancient historian Josephus who lived during that time, if we read these documents in the same way that we read any other historical documents of that time, if those historical documents have credibility, these historical documents have to have credibility. We don't get to pick and choose. So there was this giant stone. And there were these Roman soldiers who guarded that tomb so that the disciples, as some of the Pharisees thought, would come and steal his body. It wasn't that. Some people said, well, he swooned. What happened was Jesus just fainted on the cross. He didn't resurrect himself. He resuscitated himself. But again, if you look at the graphic nature of how he died, a spear jammed in his side up into his heart, the loss of blood, the shock from the fellegra, that whip with bits of lead and metal and steel. He should have died by shock alone. There's no way anyone is going to resuscitate themselves from that kind of a horrific death. And don't take my word for it, but take the word of numerous experts and physicians who have examined the way in which people died and said there's just no way that this person could survive that. So the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ was the event of that time. And it has remained the event in Western civilization. And so when we come on Resurrection Sunday to celebrate the Lord's life and death and resurrection, we do it because we understand that in that resurrection, that Jesus was able to do something that no other person was able to do. That he was able to die a horrible physical death. And he was able to resurrect himself. And in the power of that resurrection, certify, give credibility to all the other claims that he made about himself. The truth of the matter is, and if we're all intellectually honest about this, we know that on our best day, we are alienated from God. Do you know anyone that is perfect? When was the last time you had a perfect year? When was the last time you had a perfect month? How about a perfect week? When was the last time you had a perfect week? A perfect day? Anybody here have a perfect day? Is that you, Ron? You had a perfect day?
Yesterday?
No. Okay, so Ron's had a perfect day. We'll have to talk with him further. The truth of the matter is, I think for most of us who've walked into this room this morning, we've probably thought some things that we wouldn't want anybody to know that we thought in just this short period of time that we've been here. But the criteria for heaven is perfection. And that's how we know that we are alienated from God. And there's no way that you and I can achieve perfection. Jesus demonstrates this. It's a parable about forgiveness. But one of the underlying themes in the parable where, there's this master who has this servant, and the servant owes him money. And so if you take the amount of money that Jesus said in the parable about what the servant owed him, if you translated that in real money today, it's millions of dollars. It's unpayable. The debt that he owes the master cannot be paid back by anything that he does. And so by extension, Jesus is saying, the debt that we owe God is unpayable. There is no way. And so in that parable, the master forgives the debt. The only way he can come out from under the debt is by the master forgiving the debt. The only way that you and I can come out from under the debt that we have is if the master forgives our debt. And without the forgiveness of that debt, there is death. In fact, I oftentimes like to say there was a fall in the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve. There was the fall away from God, and there is a falling. I know that in our world today, people tend to say that humankind just continues to improve. And there is a certain sense in which that is true. But we continue to improve not only in what we do that is good, we also continue to improve in terms of what is bad. We have never been better at killing people than what we are today. We have never been better at killing vast amounts of people than what we are today. And we do. So there's some real debate there about whether or not we continue to improve. It's just that we have this penchant for taking the really good things that we make and finding ways to do really bad things with those really good things, which makes the really bad things that we do so much more effective. So there's this fall and there's this falling in humanity. And so there's only one recourse, and that is to have Christ interrupt that. I was saying to somebody the other day that if there was any person in the world that had every reason to become an alcoholic or a drug addict or whatever, that would be me. My father was an alcoholic. My uncle was an alcoholic. My brother had struggled with drinking. My youngest brother was a crack cocaine addict. There's a lot of abuse in the family. But it was Christ who made the difference, who interrupted that cycle in my life. It was Christ that interrupted that. Wasn't me. Wasn't my idea. Wasn't anything that I did. I'm telling you, that was... I used to go and speak on regular basis at a high school in Lancaster, Ohio. It was Lancaster High School. And there was a teacher there named Mr. Schroer. He was a member of our church. I went to a Presbyterian church then. I was the youth minister. And he would frequently, about every year, he'd have me come and speak to this honors class that he had. And he would want me to come and talk about my Christian faith and why I believed in God. And even though he sang in the church choir, I'm pretty sure he was not a Christian. He just liked the church. He liked singing in the choir, and he liked the sense of community. But I never got the sense from him which he was a believer himself. So students would ask me questions about why I believed what I believed, and they would say something to me like, "Well, how can you prove the existence of God?" And I would say things like, if you have an instrument that can only measure water, and somebody says to you, "I believe that there is air that exists." Well, why do you believe that? Because I have this instrument that I use to measure water that I can only measure water with, but because that instrument doesn't demonstrate air, therefore air must not exist. But that's what we do. We take things like the scientific method and we apply it to something that can't be used for science. We believe in a thing called metaphysics, something beyond the physical world. So I would say those kinds of things, and then I would say this. I would say, look, you need to understand. I am more convinced of the reality of God in my life than I am of you sitting in front of me. I would sooner doubt your existence than I would the existence of God in my life because of what God has done for me in my life and how he has changed me and saved me from those things. All that to say, I believe what Jesus has done for me in my life. That in this fall and this falling, that he has arrested my falling to a significant degree. And that I look forward to that time because of his resurrection, that I can be resurrected. I will not be resuscitated. I will be resurrected over into the image of Jesus Christ. Death is a very real thing. There's a story that was once said about, there was this young man who was out west. And as young men often are, kind of full of himself and very confident in his ability. You may have bumped into one or two in your lifetime. You know what I'm talking about. I was probably that way as well. And what he used to do is that he used to go out and tease grizzly bears to chase him, which isn't the smartest thing. I mean, the average grizzly bear is about 400 pounds. It has 2.5-inch canines, about 4 or 5-inch razor-sharp claws. It has a bite force of about 1,200 pounds. And it can run about 35 miles an hour. It's actually faster than the quarter horse for a short period of time. But he would go out and tease these grizzly bears. And then they would chase him, and then he would run up a tree. And adult grizzly bears can't climb trees, usually. But he would do that and tease them. And then they would be at the bottom of the tree, you know, roaring at him and, like, you know, trying to reach him and frothing at the mouth and all those kinds of things. And he would do it repeatedly. So then, after a while, he went into town. And he was in a saloon, and he was talking with some other younger guys, and he was bragging about how many times he escaped these grizzly bears, dozens of times, where he would tease them and run up the tree and escape them. And as he's looking around telling the story, his younger friends are laughing. They think this is great, but there are some of these old-timers who are sitting around, and they're just looking at him like he's absurd, ridiculous. And kind of offended that they were not laughing at his story, he said to them, I notice you're not really kind of laughing at my story. Why is that? He says, don't you think it's pretty impressive that I could escape death so many times? And one of the old timers said, you know, you can escape death dozens and dozens of times. You can win over escaping death dozens and dozens of times. But just remember, death only has to win once. So I suspect many of us in our own way have escaped death. And maybe we have a certain degree of confidence. Maybe it's how we drive a car, the kind of work that we do, whatever. And so we're pretty confident about our ability to continue on in this way. But death only has to win once. And if death wins once, and we do not trust in what Christ said he was about, that he came as a substitutionary sacrifice for our sins, that he took all of our guilt, all of our punishment on himself, that the Father punished him instead of punishing us, and that what we need to do is trust in what he did for us so that we will not be punished by the Father. That's what we have to do. That's, we don't escape this temporal death, but we do escape an eternal death. And that eternal death isn't a cessation of existence. It's simply a compromising of what is left. If you can imagine a place where God is not, if you can imagine standing before God in that first judgment, seeing him in all of his love, his power, his glory, his beauty, his holiness, all of his justice, all of his kindness, if you see God in all of that, and then because the blood of Christ doesn't cover us, and we then are cast out permanently and forever from his presence into a place where God is not, but we still remember in our head what God was, what we could have had, how we could have participated in that, and that there will be no resurrection for us. The resurrection of Jesus Christ, his defeat of death, demonstrates his power over death, his ability to fulfill what he has promised to do for us. And so on Resurrection Sunday, we come here because we are joyful for what he has done. And because there isn't another religious figure, there's not one in the history of the world that have made the claims that Christ made, that have done the things that Christ did. So do we trust that? Do we trust that? One final thing I want to say. When Jesus was on the cross and towards the end of his life, he asked for a drink and they gave him some sour wine. The thieves began to speak to him, and the one thief cursed him and told him that he should save him, the first thief, and should save himself. The second thief saw that he needed Christ, and so he basically made a confession. He said, look, I deserve what I'm getting, but this man's done nothing wrong. And he looked at Jesus and he said, remember me in your kingdom. And Jesus said, today you will be with me in paradise. You will be with me in a place of utter bliss, of joy, of pleasure. You will be with me in a place that is the exact opposite of what you are experiencing now. That's why Jesus used that word paradise. And then after that, Jesus said, it is finished. And then he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. That's in John 19:30. It is finished. And with that, he bowed his head and gave up his spirit. So what's going on there? That word finished, the Greek word, the root word of that Greek word is telos. Telos was used in that culture in three different ways. So there are derivatives of that word telos. Here they are. Jesus, in the agony of his death, very clearly used a very special word. And that word is telos, and this is it. Telos means, it was used in the business where the debt is fully paid. So anybody who heard it would have understood that in their culture, people who were in business use that word or that derivative of that word as the debt has been fully paid. Christ dying on the cross basically said, your debt is paid. The second way it was used was in the courts. And in the courts, the judge would say, would use a derivative of the word telos, and it says, the sentence is fully served. The punishment, the discipline, the sentence is fully served. So there's no bondage. The third way in which it was used was this. The war, the battle has been fully won. The battle is finished. Everybody there who heard the word, it is finished, would have understood all three applications of that word in that culture and understood that our debts are paid, that our punishment is resolved, and that the battle on our behalf, the battle against whatever battles we fight personally in our own life, the battle against Satan himself was won. That there would be no bondage in hell. And finally, Jesus pays the debt, serves our sentence, and fights our battle. But the victory over sin and death is ours. This is why we celebrate Resurrection Sunday. This is what really should give us joy, that there's a certainty in which every day in Christ is a resurrection Sunday, because we have a God who did what we could not do, because he loves us. My life is living proof of that, and there are many people in this room who would say the same thing.